Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now an update on the ongoing uprising in Ukraine, where the country is deciding whether to join economic forces with the EU or with Russia, with many seeing this as a proxy conflict between Putin and the West. Hundreds of thousands of people have flooded into the streets to protest the Ukrainian president's decision to back out of a deal with the European Union at the last minute and tilt toward Russia. Max Sedin, foreign correspondent for BuzzFeed and longtime Moscow-based reporter, joins us from Kiev. Max, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hi, Brian. Hello from Kiev. Thank you for having me.
So let me start with maybe a naive question, but why does Ukraine have to pick sides anyway? Does it necessarily have to be aligned with the EU or with Russia? Why can't it do business with everybody?
Well, it's really very simple, because the Ukrainian economy is doing very badly. Ukraine is a country that has not got enough. It has all sorts of industry in the east of the country, that is the Russian-speaking part of the country, that relies on Russia for trade, and it has $15.3 billion in debt that it's at risk of defaulting on, and it's struggling to get credits for next year. And this money is going to come from somewhere, and it isn't coming from within the country. It's not like Russia, where they have lots of natural resources they can use to make all their problems go away. And so it's really very simple, regardless of whether the leaders of the country might want to bring the country in line with either Europe or Russia. There's a strong argument that the president wants to do neither. The money is going to have to come from somewhere.
And how much is democracy the issue here, and the president's unwillingness to further democratize? Because my understanding is that the deal with the EU was going to come with some pro-democracy and good government strings attached, and the president wasn't going to go along with those, and that's why that deal fell apart. Is that accurate?
Well, that was certainly what the EU believed when they were trying to push the deal through. The association agreement involves all these tiny sorts of very bureaucratic legal tweaks to various parts of the way that Ukraine is set up to bring it in line with the EU. The idea is that this is part of the pathway to membership, although membership is never promised. And the sticking point was President Yanukovych's biggest rival, former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, who was jailed in 2011 for 7 years on abuse of office charges. And the European Union believes that she is a political prisoner. She's currently in a prison hospital in the city of Kharkov, and one of the conditions for signing the agreement was that she'd be sent to Germany so that she could get treatment for her back problem. And there was this whole tug of war. There was this mission created by the European Union with the former president of the European Parliament, the former president of Poland. It went 27 times over the space of a year and a half to Kiev to try and negotiate for her release. And it was basically the only thing of all the EU's major demands that Ukraine had not done. However, once 2 weeks ago, Ukraine actually backed out of signing the agreement with the EU, it became clear to everyone, and this was not really the issue at hand, and it's what I was talking about before, it's the money. Russia does not want Ukraine to move out of what it considers a spiteful sphere of influence, and has threatened with raising gas prices on Ukraine, which gets 60% of its energy from Russia and can barely afford to pay its gas bill to Russia. Anyway, Ukrainian trade with Russia is 25% of all Ukraine's foreign exports. And the argument from the Ukrainian government was that the EU and international money and the monetary fund deals that were on the table were just simply not enough to sustain the losses that they would incur if Russia decided to punish them, which Russia repeatedly and publicly threatened to do.
Max Sedin, foreign correspondent for BuzzFeed in Kiev, Ukraine. And listeners, anyone out there with ties to Ukraine or the region, Ukrainians, call us up, 212-433-WNYC. What's your take on what's going on in your country of origin, or if you have any other ties to Ukraine, family there, friends there. What's your take? What are you hearing from Kiev or around the country, and what do you think? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. One of the biggest stories in the world over recent days, these massive protests in Kiev, and the question of will Kiev make this trade deal with the EU, or will it make a deal with Russia, and the implications for global economics as well as democracy. 212-433-9692. If you have any connection to there and want to ask our guest a question or want to tell us what you think, 212-433-WNYC. And these protests are centered around Kiev's Independence Square, known as, Max, the Maidan. Am I saying that right?
The Maidan, yes.
And so can you describe what it's like there right now and what it's been like there when it's been packed?
Well, those of you in New York who remember Occupy Wall Street, well, definitely, if you came here, you would see something that you remember. There is a tent city. Ukraine has a long tradition of this, going back to 2004 when they had the Orange Revolution, which was a forced-day presidential revote, and it stopped Yanukovych from becoming president. So you have these tent cities, people are cooking food, there are all sorts of these volunteer organizations where they help find places to stay for activists who come in from out of town. And then if you go down the street, past the barricades they've set up, what happened was that after the square was violently cleared on Saturday morning, which is what started a big protest, a court order was passed banning all protests on the Maidan until next year. And then protesters just showed up the next day. Police ran away, and they took all the police materials they were using to seal it off, and they'd use it as barricades to stop the police getting back. Then if you go past there down the main street in Kiev, Khreshchatyk, you get the city hall, which has been completely taken over by the opposition, and it says Revolutionary HQ in graffiti on the front, and it's the same thing. It's much like an Occupy encampment. People are milling in and out, handing out food, handing out medicine, warm clothes, and helping people sleep.
Let's take a phone call. Mark in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you're Ukrainian-American?
Yes, I'm a third-generation Ukrainian-American who's been keeping in touch with I've been keeping in touch with all my friends in Ukraine over the past 2 weeks. It's been pretty incredible to see what all my friends have been up to, leaving school, leaving their jobs for indefinite periods of time to go demonstrate with all the citizens in Kiev.
What are your friends telling you is at stake as they see it?
This is their future, and a lot of them are seeing this as kind of their the last chance to really determine their own future for their country. Continuously reminding themselves that they can't stop, they can't go home, they need to stay out there as long as it takes until they get the desired result.
And the desired result would be
A future that leads towards European integration and actual rule of law, a competent governance, all of that can be achieved with a potential for European integration, European democracy standards. Everybody knows that that by leaning closer towards Russia, economically, it'll also lead to a more Eastern style of governance, continued corruption, mm-hmm. As they've grown so accustomed to in the last 20 years since independence. That would be their future if they were to lean towards a Eurasian Union with Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Russia.
Mark Ian, thank you so much for cluing us in on how your friends see that over there. And so that all makes so much common sense, Max, to us when he says that. And yet polls show a majority of people favor moving towards Europe, but it's close. So what's the divide?
Well, the divide is really in the way that Ukraine is set up and the way that Ukraine exists as a geographical entity. One of the reasons why Russia has this parochial, almost colonial attitude, you can say the words Ukraine. And Peter Baker's recent book on George W. Bush, I believe there was an anecdote on how Putin said to Bush, George, don't you understand? Ukraine means on the border. It's not a real country. You have the western part of the country where people speak the Ukrainian language predominantly, and it's much more like Central Europe. But then you have the eastern and southern parts of the country, which have lots of big manufacturing towns, and they speak Russian. And the two economies are also very differently set up. The economic reforms that Ukraine would have to go through to move closer to the European Union would, as I said, hit this manufacturing base in the east. That's also President Yanukovych's base very hard. Whereas in the early 1990s, Western Ukraine already went through a lot of that, and they have refigured more towards a service economy. They don't really have that thing to lose that the east does anymore. And Kiev, the capital, is in the middle of the country, and it is the birthplace of all Slavic culture, including Russian culture. And so everyone feels very attached to it in that way, even though Ukraine as a geographical entity has existed in many different forms, all sorts of different parts of it, have been parts of different countries, Russia, Poland, Lithuania, over the centuries.
It's kind of counterintuitive, even though I understand what you're saying about having the Slavic and therefore close to Russia heritage in Kiev, because we would usually see cosmopolitan areas as being more modernized and therefore more pro-West and pro-Western style democracy looking toward the West, and that the more conservative rural areas might be the ones you would expect to lean toward Russia. And yet it's the opposite in this case because of history.
Well, it's not really so much a country versus town divide. It's built along other things like that. If you're talking about Kiev specifically, Kiev is very much against Yanukovych. Yanukovych's party in parliamentary elections last year did absolutely dismally. They even got beaten by the far-right nationalist party, Svoboda, which has emerged as a major force during the protests. He's not very popular here at all, and I don't think that's necessarily that uncommon where you have presidents who are unpopular in their own capital city, but then if you go out to their heartland, everyone votes 60% and up for them. Mm.
Maria,
many countries.
A Ukrainian-American in Berkeley Heights, New Jersey. Maria, thank you for calling in.
Thank you for accepting my call. I would like to see more coverage of the Russian influence in Ukraine, because as a Ukrainian American, we do pay very close. I pay closer attention to what's going on than most people, obviously. But it's important to note that the police that were in Kyiv, that were brought to Kyiv, were not local. They came from Dnipropetrovsk, Donetsk, and some people say Crimea, which is more pro-Russian, which leads, me to think, and a lot of other people, that Yanukovych really does not trust the local police. You know, he had to bring in people from other places. And the other thing is, if there is such a large contingent of people who are pro-Russian, why are they not demonstrating? We are not hearing of any pro-Russian demonstrations, not in Kyiv, not in Donetsk or Dnipropetrovsk or in those places where you would expect that to be.
That's interesting. Maria, what do you think that means?
Pardon me?
What do you think that means?
What I think that means is that we don't always have the best understanding of what's going on in that part of the world. I think that there is a standard understanding of, these guys are pro-Russian, these guys are pro-West, and I'm saying it's a lot more complicated, and that there is maybe more Russian influence in other ways that are not really talked about in the West, in terms of intimidation, just in, a lot of big ways and very many small ways. And I would like to see that. Another example would be Azarov. He is the prime minister. Yesterday, one of the reasons why he was, why people didn't want him to speak is because he doesn't speak Ukrainian. Now, imagine, a prime minister of France not speaking French. you know, or a prime minister of any country not speaking that language. I mean, you know, it's a cynical attitude. And these are things that we don't hear enough about in the West.
Maria, I'm gonna leave it there and get some reactions to it. Thank you for putting so many interesting things on the table. And Max in Kiev, Max Seddon, foreign correspondent for BuzzFeed. Let's take up a couple of those things. First of all, really, the prime minister of Ukraine doesn't speak Ukrainian?
No, he's not even from Ukraine. He's from Russia. When he was 27 in the mid-1980s, he moved to Donetsk, which is in the east. It's Yanukovych's heartland, and he never learned it. The thing about the Ukrainian and Russian languages is that they're pretty similar. If you speak Russian, you can work out quite a substantial percentage of Ukrainian, and by no means mean that you can speak it. You can get by. And when you are in some parts of the country, people only speak Russian. When you're in other parts of the country, like say Kiev, people will switch freely, even within conversation groups. And then if you go to the West, even though many people in the West speak completely perfect Russian, they won't want to speak Russian to you, and you speak Russian to them, and they will speak Ukrainian back.
There are parts of the country where Ukrainian is not the primary language, right?
Yeah, there are parts of the country where basically no one speaks Ukrainian.
They're
the east and the south, where Ukrainian is much less widely used.
And the caller's other point about no coverage or perhaps no existence of pro-Russia demonstrations, just the pro-EU demonstrations, if the country is so divided, why aren't there both?
Well, the thing is, I think that it's very easy to say that, the opposition is pro-Europe and as pro-Russian, that he has his choice. He's made his choice to go away from you and go towards Russia, and that's actually not really what it is. He is widely perceived as trying to do everything he can to stay in power after the next presidential election in 2015, and that means he has to get money so that he can stop the economy from collapsing and so that he can finance his election campaign. And the way that he perceives it at the moment is that Russia is the best way for him to get that. But if you look at everything the government says, the government continues to insist that it is doing everything it can to move towards integrating with Europe, and it will eventually sign this agreement. It has only postponed the plans until the time is right from a financial point of view for Ukraine to do it. And just because these parts of the world, in say eastern and southern Ukraine, are Russian speaking, doesn't necessarily mean that they are pro-Russian. They want to be a Russian colony of some sort. So I think actually it's much more complicated than that. You do have these weird divides all over the country, but it's not as simple as these guys are pro-Europe and these guys are pro-Russian.
We have a mayor-elect Bill de Blasio announcement coming up here in New York. Shortly. He hasn't started yet, running much later than his scheduled time. We are expecting it still in a very few minutes. We'll take one more call on the crisis in Ukraine. And Dave in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I think that I've spent some time there, a fair amount of time in the last couple of years, and I think I'm going back shortly. And I think people tend to overthink it, that Yanukovych is doing most of what he's doing for domestic politics. He's got a reelect in 2015. And when he beat Tymoshenko in 2010, the opposition is split between sort of the Tymoshenko-Yatsenyuk faction and the Vitali-Klitschko faction. He knows they're split. He's looking at short-term economic pain if he'd sign the EU deal. He has no interest in signing the Russian customs union peace. He understands that eventually they have to move towards Europe. But he's just looking at domestic politics. How does he survive with the divided opposition, with the economics they've got now, with the gas deals they have with Russia? How does he survive till the 2015 election?
So, Dave, it's not clear to you, as somebody who, I gather, participated in the elections there in 2010, not clear to you that the majority of the population is pro-trade deal with EU, enough for him to rely on that?
No, the majority is pro-trade deal with the EU, but again, it's an opposition that's split in the way they run their elections. Mm-hmm. You know, you get to the second round, which he will obviously do. You know, it'll be between Klitschko and Yatsenyuk to be his opponent, and the majority of people are pro-EU. EU. But again, it's not a, he's trying to figure out if the economy collapses in the next year, if he does the EU trade deal, there's short-term pain and a very much long-term gain. And it's in the interest of the country to do that. His concern that if he signed that and Russia continued its sanctions, which it's already started 4 months ago, and if they put pressure on him with oil and gas prices, that he'll be in a much bigger trouble.
And, Dave, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. So, Max Seddon, just to wrap this up, there is this strange history of the last decade where in 2004 there was the pro-democracy protest known as the Orange Revolution, which erupted after Yanukovych was declared winner of the presidential election. Then Viktor Yushchenko was brought into power. Yanukovych was part of the opposition. But then, lo and behold, Yanukovych, the target of the Orange Revolution, was elected president in 2010. And now he's once again the target of protests. What a bizarre cycle where Ukrainians seem to vote one way and protest the other way.
Well, I think that quite often happens. I think you have the active, I don't want to say they're a minority when you have hundreds of thousands of people on the street like this, but you have some people who, when they're in the opposition, are going to express their discontent in one way, and other people who are more accustomed to voicing it at the ballot box. I think that's one of the reasons why this whole political crisis has been so difficult to predict, because the country is a divided house, and different parts of the country react very differently to different things, as we've seen.
And there we leave it with Max Seddon, foreign correspondent for BuzzFeed and longtime Moscow-based reporter, live from Kiev, where the crisis in Ukraine, with both economics and democracy at stake, continues. Hundreds of thousands of people have been in the streets over recent days. Thank you very much for all the insight, Max.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up, coverage of the expected announcement momentarily by Mayor-elect Bill de Blasio. We'll see if he announces a new police commissioner or anyone else of significance for his administration. Stay with us.